105 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Right now, there are 10 states in the U.S. with more than 10,000 power outages, the most in Michigan, where there are more than 180,000 outages. All of this because of severe winter weather. It's having another major impact on travel. Over 1,000 flights canceled today in the U.S. Snow and extreme cold, the problem in the Midwest, like in Iowa.
For me, it comes with the territory, and this is kind of what it means to live in Iowa in the middle of winter, but two snowstorms back-to-back feels like a little much.
That's also frozen the final days before the Iowa caucuses. Many in-person campaign events have been canceled for today. Taiwan's elected a new president, William Lai Ching-te. This win will likely upset China, which claims Taiwan is its own, as Beijing has called him a troublemaker. The U.S. struck Houthi targets in Yemen for the second straight night. A Houthi leader told Reuters the strikes have not impacted their ability to launch strikes on the Red Sea. This is ABC News. Mixed reactions Friday from survivors and the family members of victims of the racist mass shooting at a Buffalo, New York supermarket in 2022. They were reacting to news from federal prosecutors that they'll seek the death penalty against the shooter, Peyton Gendron. ABC's Aaron Katursky has more from Buffalo.
10 black people were killed in the attack, including Pearl Young. The death penalty doing nothing to diminish the pain of her daughter.
Whatever decisions they made, it's not going to do anything in terms of what my heart needs, and my heart needs healing.
Mark Talley's mother was Geraldine Talley.
I would have preferred he spend the rest of his life in prison, suffering every day. I think he's getting off the hook getting the death penalty.
Gendron is already serving a life sentence after pleading guilty to state charges last year.
University of Alabama's found its replacement for Hall of Fame football coach Nick Saban, hiring Kalen DeBoer from the University of Washington. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
The fastest hour in radio, serving truth, justice, and equality with every slice. Outside the Pizza Box with Pizza Box Mike. Friday nights at 7 on the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
To the big-hearted, the bold, the teachers, the growers, the builders, the change makers. We need you. We are the Peace Corps. In more than 60 countries, we go the distance to make a difference. We're volunteers, partners, communities, bringing our experience, joy, and passion to building a better world together. Are you looking for more? Then we are looking for you. Join us at peacecorps.gov.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
The brunt of air pollution and extreme weather events fueled by climate change. And state health officials say Latinos are the fastest growing racial and ethnic population in Wisconsin. According to the Pew Research Center, 71% of Latino adults around the country say climate change already affects their local community. To promote what she calls a just transition towards a climate-friendly economy for all people, Munoz says the report includes a toolkit and policy recommendations to help communities better preserve their Latino heritage.
One of the ways it's joining groups and forces to really protect our lands and prevent that from expanding, to prevent further loss and damage, which is necessary in these times of climate change.
Latinos are projected to make up 30% of the U.S. population by 2050, and over half reside in states with the highest levels of climate change threats. The Hispanic Access Foundation released its Cultural Erosion Report at the recent COP28 conference in Dubai. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Snow and wind for your Saturday. Gusts to 30 miles per hour out of the north. Temperatures falling throughout the day. For tonight, some light snow, a low of 4 below, and wind chills about 20 below. For Sunday, mostly cloudy and cold with highs in the single digits. Still breezy.
Currently, it's 10.
From Birchwood to Poplar, this is the Buzz of the North. 910 AM WBZH, your home for news, talk, and sports.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. It is Saturday, January 13th, 2024. This is our 80th broadcast here on the many broadcast stations of Civic Media throughout our wonderful state of Wisconsin and beyond. My name is Jim Santel, and yes, I'm going to be your host for the next 2 hours on this Saturday morning. This is our weekly review, our analysis, our discussion of some of the most significant, impactful news events and developments in the areas of law and government, and indeed the aspiration for justice in America. As always, I am supported and assisted so expertly this morning, as always, by my wonderful producer, Anya. She is assisted and supported this morning by our co-producer, Johnny. And together, we're in the studios of WAUK Radio, but broadcasting through to you throughout regions of our great state. We have, as always, an ambitious but achievable agenda, a wonderful academic and civics-related syllabus for you this morning. I'd like to believe it's also going to be informative and maybe even inspiring to you in terms of what you can and should do in response to our discussion this morning about law and government and justice in these United States of America. As always this morning on our broadcast, this the 80th broadcast of our Saturday morning show, we ask three principal questions and we try to answer them as well. The first question, what happened? What do we know about the world in which we live, the country in which we live, the state in which we live? What are the facts that are knowable and discernible as we think about answers to the questions that come after? What happened? The first of those questions. The next question, why are those things important? Why are they relevant? Why are they material? What is significant about them? Why are we talking about them at all? And third, what do we do about those things? In many cases, there is little we can do, but in most cases, there are things that we should do in response, in reaction, in answer to those things that are populating our lives and our livelihoods here in the state of Wisconsin, throughout the United States of America, and across the globe. Those three questions, what happened, why are those things important, and what should we do about them, all a part of our Saturday morning syllabus. Happy to have you join me for our ambitious but achievable, informative, hopefully inspiring discussion, as always here on the broadcast station, your broadcast station of Civic Media. This morning, our syllabus, again, diverse and important to understanding our world. We're going to be talking initially about some international cases. We began at the last segment of our last show last week by talking about things happening in Israel and also in Chile. I'm going to go back to those and give you more definition for them, some more understanding about why those particular stories are important and the lessons that they may share for us here in the United States of America as we begin this all-important year 2024 in the government of our country, in the politics of our nation, in campaigns for the highest offices, middle offices, all important offices of public service in our state and in our nation. We're also going to go to the nation of Suriname and talk about a significant event happening there. And then we're going to go overseas once again to The Hague in the Netherlands and talk about a major case that was prosecuted and defended just this past week. All of those things in Israel, in Chile, in Suriname, and in the Netherlands at The Hague, all of them with lessons about the rule of law and the understanding of justice in our nation as well, taken from the international world, some pieces of undiscovered justice, not much covered this past week by our national and even our local media, but important to understanding our own world right here in our own localities, our counties, our state, and our nation. Then, the second portion of our syllabus this morning, we're going to come back to the United States of America, having gone overseas for much of our first hour, and we're going to talk about some major trials that, yes, have indeed animated a lot of the media coverage just this past week. We'll talk about that civil fraud trial in the state of New York that just wrapped up yesterday, Friday, with some closing arguments by the state of New York and also by lawyers for Donald Trump, the past president, being sued in that case by the attorney general alleging violations, state violations in a civil proceeding by Donald Trump and his sons and his company for valuations of property there in the state of New York in violation of the rules and regulations about how corporations are supposed to work in New York. Closing arguments just this past week, just these past days. We're going to talk about those as well. Then we're going to talk about another case also going ahead in New York. That one begins this coming week. It's another case in the civil arena involving E. Jean Carroll. Yes, indeed, another defamation case against the former president underway in federal court beginning this coming week. Then we're going to go to Washington, D.C. and talk about what is perhaps the single most significant judicial proceeding of the week, because it may indeed affect the future of these several prosecutions against the former president. It has to do with whether or not the concept of presidential or executive immunity actually exists in America under our Constitution and under our laws. The D.C. Court of Appeals entertaining oral argument this past week in its courtroom, determining and sending us some very clear messages about whether or not this concept exists under the rule of law, under our system of justice in our nation. Both of those cases that we've talked about, the case in New York involving civil fraud, and also the Court of Appeals case in Washington, D.C., both of those attended by Donald Trump, both of them proceeding in his presence. We'll talk about that as well. And then the fourth case we're going to talk about in our second hour is one of the many cases now joining approximately 1,200 prosecutions going ahead in the wake of the assault on our democracy, on the attack on our Capitol on January 6th. This involving the prosecution of a Montana fire chief, now brought into our federal criminal justice system for his involvement in the riot on January 6th. We're going to talk about that and make sense of it in context of these other cases also involving Donald Trump. Finally, as always, we're going to chat a bit about the Supreme Court, active a lot this past week when it comes to deciding a number of different cases, hearing oral arguments on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. I'm going to chat with you very briefly about the content of those. And then we're also going to talk more about what's coming up next week. And to tantalize you in anticipation of that discussion, I'm going to tell you more about a case coming up next Wednesday, the 17th, which I believe, even in the midst of these important cases involving the Supreme Court's attention, having to do with guns and social media and the future of our agencies and the Trump cases, this single most significant case involving something called the Chevron Doctrine and inside that agency determination, the future of our federal agencies, how they operate, and the connection between them and federal district court and appellate court judges around the country. I believe one of the most significant cases of this term, and arguably in recent terms, having to do with the way in which federal courts interact with agencies, and most importantly, the ways in which federal agencies behave and conduct themselves in connection with supporting you and providing service to you and the kinds of things that you should indeed anticipate and expect from a government that truly is responsive to you. The United States Supreme Court is going to comment on that probably in June. I'm going to talk about that case that's coming up for oral argument next Wednesday and certainly next week in our broadcast following those oral arguments of this coming Wednesday. We'll talk. We'll try to read the tea leaves from the Supreme Court argument of this coming Wednesday. An awful lot on our plate today, a lot on our syllabus, but once again, ambitious and achievable, hopefully inspiring and informative along the way as well. So let us begin. Let us begin with our academic movement through some pieces of largely undiscovered justice having to do with things in our world of just these past several weeks. Again, the first of these, certainly the subject of a lot of attention overseas, and yes, indeed, in our nation as well, because as we have talked at great length on this broadcast and others of civic media, the interchange between the executive branch and the judicial branch, indeed the legislative branch as well, is critical to an understanding of how government works. Every single republic, every single true democracy out there has at least some vestiges in some ways of three branches of government, as we well know. That is the courts, that's a legislative branch or body that makes the laws, and then there's a branch that executes the laws, that puts those laws into operation. As you know well from our previous discussions of this particular case, in recent months, frankly, recent years, the present prime minister of Israel, his name is Benjamin Netanyahu. He is in the news a lot these days because of the Hamas-Israel war, and we're going to talk about that as well in just a few moments in connection with another legal proceeding overseas. Benjamin Netanyahu, a lot of focus on him in recent times because of the war and the statements that he has made in prosecuting that war, but also much in the attention of national news watchers and all of us, because he has been charged inside his own state of Israel, domestically, by the courts, by the prosecutors there, with some allegations of fraud and a misconduct in his office as prime minister. And so it was significant that just this past week, when it came to resolving a major issue having to do with a proposal by Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, to limit the capacity of courts to do what courts do in Israel and, yes, in every democracy around the planet, the Supreme Court of the State of Israel issued a major decision, a major opinion that's going to affect the balance of power in Israel, that comments upon this relationship between the executive branch and the courts. When we come back after this, our first break, we're going to tell you more about that major decision, that rule of law decision coming out of the Supreme Court of the State of Israel. Stay with me for that all-important discussion.
Listening to the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
Stop. That dog does not want to be petted.
A heads up before something bad happens.
You should not send that text.
Uh-oh. Life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes, you can reverse prediabetes and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. To learn your risk, take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Think you'd like working with us at Civic Media? We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin. If you have the right skills to join our team, let's talk. Civic Media is a proud equal opportunity employer committed to diversity and inclusion, along with the growth and development of all current and future employees. If you're interested or are part of an organization who wants to know more, go to our website, civicmedia.us, and click on the Careers tab.
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
And we are back here in our Saturday morning broadcast, talking initially about this major case involving the rule of law in Israel that has implications for us right here in our own nation and our own state. This was the first rule of law news event of the new year, January 1 of this year, a major decision coming out of the Israeli Supreme Court. And that case, a momentous ruling that could in fact ignite something of a constitutional crisis in the country of Israel, because on Monday, January 1 this year, the Supreme Court in Israel struck down a law that was passed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government, including, of course, the parliament there, that was meant, in effect, to limit the court's own powers. And that was done by a majority of 8 judges to 7. It was a divided court, much as we have seen here in our own United States Supreme Court. Now, the decision is likely to rekindle a grave domestic situation that we reported on here in our Saturday morning broadcast and in others of Civic Media that sparked nationwide protests when proposals by the Netanyahu government to limit the role, limit the discretion, limit the power of the judiciary in Israel were met by protests and by objection, strong objection. People in Israel took to the streets, professionals of all kinds, and people of all kinds, of ages, races, a national origin, all kinds of people took to the streets in Israel, and they protested this movement by the Netanyahu government to try to limit the capacity of the Supreme Court and other courts there in Israel to do the job in the way it was supposed to do. The court, again, on January 1, a couple of weeks ago, sitting with a full panel of all 15 judges, for the first time in its history, the first time in Israeli history, the Supreme Court in that nation, at that time rejected, again, by a split in its membership, rejected this law that was passed by Parliament. And that law was passed back in July of this last year. What did it specifically do? It barred judges across the board in all judicial positions from using a particular legal standard called reasonableness to overrule decisions made by government ministers. And you can see why it is that maybe the executive branch would be concerned about this issue. If indeed there is a change in the standard that gives the executive branch more discretion to do whatever it wants to do, that can not only limit the judiciary's role, but also increase the executive role when it comes to the administration of justice. So what do we need to know about what happened on January 1 and why this is so important in terms of the rule of law and the balance of power between the executive branch and the legislative branch and also the executive branch? The governing coalition, Benjamin Netanyahu's governing coalition, at the time was exercising its authority, trying to establish once again some level of supremacy over the decisions of the judiciary. They argued, as I said, that this legal concept, this principle of reasonableness, which the court used about a year or so ago to strike down some of Netanyahu's appointments, in particular, there was a finance minister who was a political ally of his. They struck that appointment down because on the basis of reviewing that process and the substance of that appointment, determined that it was not a reasonable thing for the executive branch to do. And that particular person had been convicted of tax fraud. The concern, of course, was that this was an unbridled, inappropriate excursion by the judiciary into the executive branch. That was the allegation made by Netanyahu and his government. The Likud party, which is the party advanced and which is led by Netanyahu, called the Supreme Court decision basically pushing back on and restricting, limiting this attempt to limit its own authority. They called that decision on January 1 in opposition to the nation's desire for unity, especially in a time of war. The Likud party, including Mr. Netanyahu, slammed the court for ruling on the issue when Israeli soldiers are fighting and endangering themselves in battle, which is what he said. There are others, of course, on the opposite side that heralded this decision, that struck down this law that would have limited the Supreme Court's discretion, its ability to review actions of the executive branch. The Kaplan Force, which is one of the activist groups in Israel that had organized these major protests of this past year against this kind of judicial reform, praised the Supreme Court's decision at the time and called on all parties, everyone in the state of Israel, saying today one chapter ended in the battle to protect democracy and a victory for the citizens of Israel. So again, strong disagreement about what the Supreme Court has done. For months, as I said, the opponents of Israel's judicial overhaul had crowded the streets of cities like Tel Aviv and Jerusalem to protest the Supreme Court overhaul, which aimed to lessen the court's powers. The protesters said those measures would leave the court unable to prevent government overreach, and many feared that the Netanyahu government in particular, which would be unbounded then by independent courts, would find it easier to prosecute, to limit the prosecution of Benjamin Netanyahu, which is how we began this reporting. Why is all of this important? Why is it significant for America? Well, plainly Israel, one of our major allies in this nation, but also a signal about how judicial matters should work in any democracy. That is, proposals here by the parliament, by the executive branch, reviewed by the judicial branch. In the end, the justices there determining that the legislative decision was an overreach and that, in fact, the executive branch, the prime minister, and the parliament that had passed this law was not doing that consistent with the laws, the understandings of how government is to work. That's how that checks and balance process should indeed work. One can disagree with the result by the Supreme Court, which is also the glory and the joy of republics, to be able to articulate your disagreement with a Supreme Court, to find that indeed the opposition party is the one that has the greater sway when it comes to arguments. All of that is a part of a free and open democracy. We will see where this goes in Israel, but significant that that happened after months and years of protest over the proposal itself. It may not be the last word, as it often is not in democracies, as we have seen here in the United States of America. Just because the Supreme Court articulates in our nation what it is that they feel is the law does not mean that others have that same view. When we come back, we'll talk more about another story having to do with Chile. Stay with us for that discussion.
Hometown station for news, talk, and sports. This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Right now, there are 10 states in the U.S. with more than 10,000 power outages, the most in Michigan, where there are more than 180,000 outages. All of this because of severe winter weather. It's having another major impact on travel. Over 1,000 flights canceled today in the U.S. Snow and extreme cold, the problem in the Midwest, like in Iowa.
For me, it comes with the territory, and this is kind of what it means to live in Iowa in the middle of winter, but two snowstorms back-to-back feels like a little much.
That's also frozen the final days before the Iowa caucuses. Many in-person campaign events have been canceled for today. Taiwan's elected a new president, William Lai Ching-te. This win will likely upset China, which claims Taiwan is its own, as Beijing has called him a troublemaker. The U.S. struck Houthi targets in Yemen for the second straight night. A Houthi leader told Reuters the strikes have not impacted their ability to launch strikes on the Red Sea. This is ABC News.
It's the Packers and the Cowboys. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Packers take on the Dallas Cowboys in the wild card playoffs. Kickoff at AT&T Stadium at 3:30. The Cowboys are experienced, and they've won 16 games at home in a row. But the Packers beat teams like the Kansas City Chiefs. Will that help them Sunday? Quarterback Jordan Love.
Yeah, like you said, I mean, they're a really good team, a really good defense. So definitely one of the best defenses we've seen all year. Yeah, like you said, going back to the Kansas City game, Detroit, I mean, those are two games we played really good defense as well. So just having that mindset, we got to play our best ball.
Green Bay is 5-0 in playoff games played in Dallas. Mike McCarthy met his wife Jessica in Green Bay. They've had children. Does he still have Packer fans in his house?
I mean, I'm living, I got a wife and three daughters, obviously two sons, but, you can't win in that house. that's a great question, Clarence. I can't believe I'm saying that to you today. But, yeah.
That's Cowboys head coach Mike McCarthy. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Snow and wind for your Saturday. Gusts to 30 miles per hour out of the north. Temperatures falling throughout the day. For tonight, some light snow, a low of 4 below, and wind chills about 20 below. For Sunday, mostly cloudy and cold with highs in the single digits. Still breezy.
Currently, it's 10.
People across Wisconsin are enjoying the rewards, stability, and flexibility of a career in healthcare. Why not you? Wish Caregiver Careers can get you started as a certified direct care professional. You'll learn the skills you need to make life better for older adults or people with a disability. All training is free and online, plus earn $500 in bonuses. Start your new career. Sign up today at WISCCaregiverCDCP.com. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
We all have someone we love, like the favorite lyric in our favorite song. You can't imagine life without them. Cancer screening tests can help keep the person you love around longer by detecting changes before cancer develops, or catch it early when it may be easier to treat. And many tests are available for free or covered by insurance. It's time to sound like a broken record. Tell all your friends and family, I love you. Get screened. Visit cancer.org/get screened to learn more.
There are 1,000 ways to say it.
Nope. Knock it off. Shut it down. Dream on. No dice. Give it a rest. Not a chance.
Or just
all text. You focus on the road.
As a passenger, you have the power to prevent an accident. There are 1,000 ways to stop a distracted driver. Choose one.
A message from CTIA.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it. Navigating without a compass. Eyes waiting. Started to wonder. Metamorphosis. The loss of who you thought you was.
When your kid can't find the language, help them find the lyrics. Listen to the Sound It Out album and get tips and tools to start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
Hayward's choice for news, talk, and sports. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Spoken in our first segments about this significant decision coming out of the State of Israel, including the Supreme Court decision to overrule, to reject this proposal by the Netanyahu government to limit the authority of judges and justices in Israel. Let's move to another story, also in the rule of law, also overseas. It has to do with Chile and its constitution. Significant issues here, which we've also talked about in the distant past here on our Saturday morning broadcast. Chileans recently rejected a new constitution, looking at a new constitution that would, from all perspectives, have pulled the country probably to the right, likely ending now a very turbulent, about a four-year process to replace their national charter with little to show for it, and basically going back to the constitution that was in place before this entire process worked. Recently, nearly 56% of voters in Chile rejected the proposal for a new constitution, and that amount based upon the most recent counts coming out of that nation. What is this story all about? The second time in 16 months that Chile, this South American nation of 19 million people, has rebuffed a proposed constitution. The other constitution was written by people on the left side of the political calculus. And all of this shows, again, in lessons for us here back in America, how deeply that nation, like ours is, remains over the set of rules and regulations by which it is to be governed after about 4 years of debate. That debate began in 2019, way back in 2019, after there were enormous protests. They were prompted by a national referendum back in 2019. In that referendum, as a result of it, about 4 out of 5 Chileans voted to scrap their then existing constitution, and a heavily amended version of the 1980 text adopted under the bloody military dictatorship of General Augusto Pinochet. Many of you remember him well from history, a major figure, a dark figure in Chilean history. A decision, again, beginning back in 2019, now having failed to agree on a new text, the nation will muddle through with the constitution that so many had voted to replace. That constitution of Augusto Pinochet remains in place. In the wake of this back and forth by Chilean voters in recent years, the present president in Chile said this. His name is Gabriel Boric. He said, "I want to be clear. During my term, the constitutional process, that is the people of Chile deciding on which constitution they will embrace if either one of them, is now closed," he said. He said the country became polarized and divided, and despite this conclusive result, the constitutional process by which the people identify which constitution they will embrace, which constitution they will adopt, failed to channel the hopes of achieving a new constitution written by all. Those are the comments, those are the words of President Boric in Chile in the wake of this vote of recent times coming out of the Chilean population. The process here is significant because, once again, it shows not only the divisions inside the Chilean population, but this attempt to identify a new constitution that would replace the one that was put in place by Pinochet many years ago. Chileans twice elected, mostly political outsiders, some doctors, some engineers, some lawyers, farmers, some social workers, other people, to constitutional assemblies to draft some new proposed charters. They sent basically to their seat of government a representative group among them to put together a new constitution. But those bodies that they sent, we would call it a constitutional convention here in our nation, they ended up with creating a long and very complicated series of constitutions that were each in their own ways partisan reflections of their own political views and political inclinations. And as a result of that, the Chilean population in these two series of elections of recent times rejected the one on the left and then rejected the one on the right. The left-leaning assembly last year offered a constitution that would have expanded abortion rights in the constitution, given some indigenous groups there in Chile more sovereignty, and enshrined a number of civil rights in the constitution, including a right to housing, to internet access, to clean air, and to care, as the constitution text said, from birth to death. That was one of the constitutions that was proposed, ultimately rejected by Chileans as being too liberal, as some of them said, too much to the left. After 60% of the ballots rejected that particular text, the voters elected conservatives to put together and control a new constitutional assembly, and that group is the one that came up with the latest constitution. That proposal would have given the private sector a prominent role in things like health and education and social security, social welfare generally. And that proposal also generated this fierce opposition. Voters were overwhelmed, if you will, by the complexity of that second attempt to put together a new constitution, some contradictory information in the public domain about what the two constitutions would or would not have done, misinformation flying from both sides as a result of this process, again, shades of what we have experienced here in the United States of America. What is the result of this? And again, why is it important to understand what happened there in Chile? People went to the polls to try to adopt a new constitution. They have a divided population there, not right down the middle, but fairly close, as we do perhaps in our nation as well. And in the end, as the president recently declared, the process, while it's difficult to say that it did not work, certainly did not result in the adoption of a constitution that everyone felt had to replace the one that Pinochet had put together many years ago. And so for now, at least, the people of Chile will not have a new constitution, but will continue, as many folks have said there, to muddle through with a constitution that is old and does not properly reflect probably the views of the left, the right, even those majority who may be in the middle. And so we'll continue to watch that story as well about the capacity of a people to define what their constitution, what their government is all about. In the case of Chile, at least for now, in 2023 and 2024, unable to come to a decision and therefore keeping their present constitution in place. Lessons for America, perhaps, in both directions about the future of our nation, just as it is about that nation in South America. And then we go a third case, a third matter, also involving the rule of law, also involving a significant major nation in the South American continent. And this case, again, comes out of Suriname. Former Suriname president, his name is Desi Bouterse. His conviction for involvement in the killing of 15 people more than four decades ago was upheld by the judicial and other governmental authorities back in December. And now, as a result of a decision made by the public prosecutor just this past week, the former president, again, Desi Bouterse, must report to prison this coming week in the wake of his conviction for the killing of 15 people 40 years ago. A three-judge panel there, again, the judiciary involved in making this decision to implement the rule of law there in Suriname, affirmed the convictions of Bouterse and four others in the execution of government critics, lawyers, journalists, union leaders and soldiers, also university professors, in December of 1982. He undertook this, according to the findings of the court, as a part of his actual oversight and administration of government. Bouterse, 78, had dominated politics in this former Dutch colony there in South America for decades. He left office in 2020. He, of course, denied the charge, but was sentenced to 20 years in prison. The former president and his army leader have until Monday to request a pardon. They have not done that as of the time that we are talking about this right now. And again, according to the judicial authorities now, Bouterse and the others are required to show up and appear at the Suriname jail along with the four co-defendants to begin service of their term. The current president, his name is Chan Santoki, investigated these so-called December murders when he was a police commissioner and later as a justice minister pushed the case to move forward. The court ruled, again as a predicate to what was just announced recently, way back in 2019, that Bouterse had overseen an operation in which soldiers abducted 16 leading government critics, as I identified them just a moment or so ago, murdering 15 of them at a colonial fortress in the capital of that nation. The former president, again, Desi Bourtesi, said in the past that the murdered men were connected to an invasion plot. That's how he explained what had happened to these people in Suriname. He said they were involved in an invasion plot involving the Netherlands and, yes, indeed, the United States of America. That was, of course, rejected as a defense in that case. And as a result of all of this, the former leader of their nation in Suriname is now required to show up to begin serving his 20-year term of imprisonment coming this week. What is the significance of that for our nation? We are not used to this notion where a former president is prosecuted. We do not know what will happen plainly with Donald Trump in 2024 and beyond. But the reality is that in other nations around the face of the planet, there are situations, there are circumstances where the judiciary, prosecutors, the rule of law is invoked to ensure that no one is above the law. In this particular case, the ex-Suriname president convicted of killings, these ordered killings by him and others, convicted of that and now facing the sentence imposed upon him as a part of the administration of justice, the search for the rule of law. And I would offer, based upon the results of this process, taking 20 years to finally adjudicate, finally coming to a place where the person responsible for them, according to the prosecutors, according to the courts in Suriname, now going to prison for that misconduct involving killings of people who are plainly his political adversaries and others while he was in office. Significant as we understand what may or may not happen in the United States in the years to come. And finally, we have beginning just this past week a major piece of litigation. It is in the International Court involving South Africa and Israel. This involves The Hague, in particular, an allegation brought by South Africa against Israel. South Africa, representatives of that nation, and Israel exchanged some allegations and, in fact, argued before The Hague, which is the top UN court, about what is going on right now in Israel and Hamas. And in particular, the International Court of Justice, the ICJ at The Hague, which is also known as the World Court, held sessions on Thursday and Friday of this past week. And a case was initiated by South Africa in late December. And in that case, brought by South Africa in this international court against the State of Israel, claiming that Israel had failed to uphold its obligations under the 1948 Genocide Convention. We do not know what will happen as a result of the arguments, presentations made in front of The Hague just in the past couple of days, but we do know about how this came about and what the positions of the parties have been as articulated in just the past couple of days. Both parties, both Israel and the state of South Africa, are right now parties to this convention, which obliges them to not commit genocide and also to prevent and punishment. When we come back after this break, I'm going to tell you more about the opposing positions articulated in The Hague just in the past couple of days and what the court there, the timing of the court's decision, which will probably be years in the making. Stay with us for that discussion about the fourth of these international cases involving the rule of law. Thank you.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Women hear a lot about self-care these days. Advice on ways to relax, exercise, eat healthy, and more. Those are all great. But one of the most important self-care steps we can take is making sure we're financially secure later in life. That means saving money for retirement. It's never too late to start. And it's the kind of self-care that brings peace of mind that lasts. For small steps you can take to save for retirement, visit WeSaySaveIt.org. That's WeSaySaveIt.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Back for this, our final segment of this, our first hour in our Saturday morning broadcast, talking about international matters that focus upon the rule of law and that also give us some instruction, some guidance about how we are to administer the rule of law here in the United States of America as well. Important to understand that we are a part of an international community, and as a part of our discussion this morning, now looking to The Hague in the Netherlands for this dispute between South Africa and Israel. And right before the break, I explained the jurisdictional basis of this court. Both countries having signed on to an agreement that obliges them not to commit genocide and also to prevent and to punishment. The treaty defines genocide as acts committed with the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. The undeniably politically charged hearings that took place at The Hague just in the past couple of days will deal in the future as the court wrestles with the resolution of that. They certainly focused on it in the past couple of days with South Africa's request for emergency measures that would order Israel to suspend its military actions in Gaza, while the courts hear the merits of the case. So a focus on an injunctive attempt to stop Israel from doing what it's doing, a process, again, that could take years. And again, let's talk about what the opposing parties are saying about this. The South African president had said before the proceedings were initiated, he said this: "Our opposition to the ongoing slaughter of the people of Gaza has driven us as a country to approach the ICJ," again, that's the International Court, "as a people who once tasted the bitter fruits of dispossession, discrimination, racism, and state-sponsored violence, we are clear that we will stand on the rights of history," and indeed, that's what South Africa argued during the course of the past couple of days. Now, on the opposite side, again, this is how the rule of law works, right? This is how justice is administered in an international community as it is in a national community. Israeli government, the spokesperson there, and the advocates there, said the state of Israel will appear before and has appeared before the International Court of Justice to dispel what they called South Africa's absurd blood libel, as Pretoria gives political and legal cover to the Hamas rapist regime. That's what the Israeli defenders of this have said, and went on to say this: "On October 7th, Hamas committed an act of genocide when it sent death squads to invade Israel with the mission of burning, beheading, torturing, mutilating, abducting, and raping as many Israelis as they could, as brutally as they could. It was a campaign," the Israeli lawyers and presenters said. "It was a campaign of systemic extermination that they have vowed to continue until our country, Israel, is destroyed. We are fighting to bring the October 7th monsters to justice, because never again is now."
And so, as you know, plainly in the wake of those descriptions of both sides of this presentation to The Hague this past week, very, very hotly contested, underscoring once again not only the nature of those differing views, but about the importance of the rule of law even inside The Hague, once again underscoring the notion that it is through this process of presenting evidence, making arguments, that resolutions, certainly imperfect, certainly not in the agreement of everyone who comes out of them, are ultimately rendered. We will see what the International Court does as a practical matter in this particular case, not only because of the focus, the extensive focus of the allegations, and the equally extensive nature of the defense in this case. It is predicted that the International Court of Justice there, The Hague, will take years to determine exactly what will happen here. We certainly all hope that the war in the Middle East involving Hamas and Israel will be long over by the time they were to render any decision here in The Hague in the Netherlands in the wake of this case. But it is significant as well, as I indicated, that South Africa is also seeking some injunctive relief from the court, asking that Hamas and the Israelis involved with them in this war also be subject to more immediate judgment. And the judgment that South Africa is looking for is a directive that Israel stop some version of the war that it is now undertaking. A basis for many people, obviously reasonable people, can in fact make arguments on both sides of this. The notion and the reason why this is important to understand what's going on in our national arena, on our national and international scale, is that this is how legitimate judicial bodies should in fact undertake to hear evidence and to resolve cases ultimately. Again, as I said before, not to the resolution, the complete satisfaction of everyone, but based upon a system of laws and justice to which we have all agreed. We will continue to monitor that case as well going forward in The Hague. All of those rule of law cases, again, involving Israel, involving Suriname, involving Chile, and involving South Africa and the Middle East and Hamas and Israel, all of them speaking to us here in America as well, and giving us some instruction about the rule of law, about the delivery of justice in the international forum, from which we may or may not take perfect lessons, but nonetheless understand the importance of the trifurcation of government, that is an executive branch, a judicial branch, and plainly a legislative branch as well. When we come back, we're going to come back to the United States of America and talk about matters and cases pending in our own courts. Stay with us for the next hour here on our Saturday morning broadcast.
Rice Lake's choice for news, talk, and sports. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. It's your hometown radio, refreshed.
Latrell spent more than 8 years in foster care. His world changed when he was adopted at 15 with help from the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption.
I think about how much we love him, and I wish we could have had him for his entire childhood.
The foundation is changing the lives of thousands of teens waiting in foster care. You can help. Learn more at DaveThomasFoundation.org.
This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm